This is an audio recording of the Lendit FinTech Weekly News Show. The show is streamed live on Lendit TV, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Twitter at 5 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday. In this fast-paced show, the Lendit News team and a special guest discuss the most important FinTech news stories of the past week. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the FinTech Nexus Weekly News Show. My name is Peter Renton, chairman and co-founder of FinTech Nexus, joined as always by my good friend and colleague, Todd Anderson. How are you doing, Todd?
I'm doing well, Peter. How are you?
Doing great. And our special guest this week, returning champion, Lindsay Davis. How are you doing, Lindsay?
Doing swell, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing well.
Yep, doing great.
Thanks for coming back.
Okay, just give us a quick 30-second intro about Atomic and that sort of thing, just before we get going.
So, everyone new to the live stream, I'm Lindsay Davis, head of markets over at Atomic. We build payroll connectivity, which enables neobanks and FIs to switch direct deposit within their financial applications, as well as access income and employment verification data straight from a payroll system. Prior to that, I was the fintech analyst at CB Insights, so I love doing these types of news shows to keep me on my toes, what's going on in the industry.
All right. Well, let's kick it off, because I think the biggest story of the week came out actually over the weekend, and this was from Bloomberg. Goldman Sachs seems to be pulling back from their dreams of having a major consumer bank. CEO David Solomon has been reported as saying that, you know, they're going to be restructuring and changing things around. And it looks like the checking account, the often talked about checking account that's been kind of in process for years now, may not happen, certainly not to the consumer. They may offer it to a small subset of people, but it's not going to be a mass market consumer checking account that we're going to have. So big news out of Goldman. What do you guys think?
Goldman's figured out how hard it is to build a fintech.
Right.
Because clearly this has not gone the way that they'd hope. And I'd wonder if the result would be different if they didn't suffer massive losses the last 6 to 8 months compared to the previous year where they had record profits. Mm-hmm. So I think they're feeling the pressure of the balance sheet and the overall pressure of the economy. The thing that surprised me was how little the after reporting was of this story. Kind of, you have this story, come in Monday and it's a huge story, and then it's been kind of crickets since then. Right. We had, we'll talk about another Goldman story that we saw today, which was kind of the other piece that we heard from them. But I'm still surprised about that. Maybe they're being super quiet outside of the sources that talk to Bloomberg, but Goldman's found out that building a consumer facing business is not as easy as they might have hoped it was. Mm-hmm.
To complement your point, Todd, I think from a revenues perspective, they have to keep their eye on home base, and by going off and diverting their strategy and their prime resources to what has largely already been a huge tech investment and somewhat, in some would say, a loss in their scenarios, that makes sense to refocus the strategy. But however, to your point, the next article that we're going to dive into, Goldman is still doing things around the consumer engagement scenario. Where they've excelled has been in the high yield savings department with Marcus, being able to acquire roughly $1 billion in deposits within a month of launching. And it's continued to do incredibly well. And targeting those high net worth individuals makes sense. Mm-hmm. But to your point, it is incredibly hard and it's incredibly saturated, right? We talk about neobanks mm-hmm. often, and some are still able to go out and raise. But for those that aren't serving a particular unique demographic that has otherwise been underserved or has something unique to offer, they're all kind of the same. And so Goldman's not trying to differentiate on that experience. They're trying to be, as they've always been, a powerhouse of deposits and investments and assets.
Right, right. And the interesting thing, I mean, they have had a brain drain at markets.
They've lost a lot of talent there.
Do you think some of the talent stuff could be related to like the difference of opinion of what Goldman should be doing in terms of their traditional business and this new consumer brand, and like some of the people that were
certainly
in Goldman felt like, hey, this isn't the Goldman that we were hoping it was.
Right.
old guard versus the new guard. And if the new guard was acquired via an acqui-hire or via, you know, a tech business, then those golden handcuffs are gone and there's no incentive for them to continue to beat a drum against a, you know, established institution that's trying to change. But if the leadership team hasn't fundamentally changed and been restructured, then it's often lost.
Yeah. And I would, I mean, out of, like, they've raised, they've put billions of dollars into this.
Like, a lot of money.
Yeah. It really is pretty, pretty amazing that they haven't made more traction. I mean, obviously their lending product is pretty solid. The deposits, as you said, I mean, I read there are over $100 billion in deposits now.
It's wild.
That's a significant business.
It's incredible. Yeah. I would say on the brain drain component, though, I am optimistic, as always, in the future of fintech, in that those people that left, some of them have already been entrepreneurs going to found a new business. Yep. And key talent, like we know that level, what was Adam Dell's business prior to this?
Clarity.
He's gone and he's working on his new consumer-facing app to redo and learn from the mistakes. And then, of course, the institutional knowledge that you leverage from being at Goldman, like, you do learn a lot. It is a great place to learn and to understand how does a bureaucratic organization work and thrive. I think that there's a next chapter that's ahead of us, and certainly we'll see more from them.
Yep. For sure. Okay, so let's move on. This was prefaced by both Todd and Lindsay. We have another story out of Goldman Sachs, really out of Apple, actually.
Apple Sachs.
Yes, Apple Sachs. There you go. You know, Apple's had, obviously, they've had
Goldman apples would have been better. Golden Delicious. Goodness. That was a miss. I'll take it.
Golden Apple. There you go. So we have, this Apple Cash that's been sitting. I have an Apple card, and I looked. I have $21.36 in my Apple Cash account right now. And what they're saying is that you are going to be able to earn interest on that, because that earns nothing.
$32.93, sir.
You're beating me, Lindsay.
Yeah. How little we're using their cards. Ding, yes. Ding. Like, they need to make this card worth more for us customers.
Yeah, I use it for Apple transactions.
Yeah, 3% for this, lovely new purple phone on brand.
Exactly.
So otherwise, anyway, it's been a dud. I don't know. It's been a total dud. So this high yield savings thing could be interesting.
Yeah. So they got a high yield savings product that they're going to be launching. It's obviously this is Apple, they're not a financial institution. They are partnering with Goldman Sachs again on this product, and no fees, no minimum deposits, no minimum requirements, and you're going to be able to deposit funds. You're going to link your bank account, so it's going to be a true savings account on Apple, which is going to be pretty cool.
Will you be able to? So the funds, will they be available on the wallet? I actually didn't get to dig too into the.
I think so. Yeah, it'll be available.
So you'll be able to spend the cash, and that is unique. Because right now, if you put your money in a high yield savings account like a Marcus, you'd have to move it. You'd have to ACH out because they don't have that consumer bank account. And similar to a Wealthfront, where you put the money in, you can now. They do have a bank card, but again, those accounts are not linked. It's sitting in a separate account, savings ACH'd over to your deposit account. Like, that's a pretty neat unhack. I'm realizing with you both in real time right now. I researched a lot. It's a good move for Goldman too, right? Yeah. If they've already tapped out that initial deposit stream, having, you know, acquired over $100 billion, to your point, they need new ground to go. And this is a cool partnership for them that plays on an existing contract that they already have, right? Like, really light due diligence to sign an addendum and move on.
Yeah,
and this is what we're going to see from Goldman most likely going forward, is anyone that they currently have deals with, they'll double down on, figure out ways to amplify the products that have made most sense and that have been most successful, and just pull back on some of the other stuff that obviously they've sunk a lot of money into, but haven't given enough return for them to keep it in progress.
Okay, so... Moving on from Goldman Sachs, we want to talk about Step. This is the fintech or digital, really a neobank for teenagers. My teenager, I have two teenagers. One is an avid Step user, and so have firsthand kind of experience using the product. They've raised $300 million, not in equity, but in debt, which is interesting. Certainly, it probably didn't get the valuation they're looking for, I'm guessing. Said, okay, we'll just do it in debt. And, they, like, according to the CEO, you read the articles, they have a pretty strong balance sheet right now. They're obviously getting this up, looking to, strengthen the balance sheet. No idea what terms they got. I can't imagine it was as good as what you would have gotten a year ago as far as a debt deal. But anyway, they also launched crypto investing with this announcement, and which I know my daughter's actually keen to start buying some crypto.
So, watch out for the bridges, girl.
Yep,
they're leaking.
I mean, it seems that Step has figured out one thing a lot of other neobanks haven't, which is the financial literacy aspect. I know a lot of other neobanks put this, financial literacy as a core thing that they do, but it's not really core to what they do. It's there. You can click on it. You can find it. It's kind of core to what Step does. And I think anything that helps younger people better understand financial services is good. I'd be curious how they're rolling out crypto investing, since it's, the financial literacy and crypto investing kind of go hand in hand and how people should understand how crypto works. But to me, that's been one of the bigger benefits of having Step, is just teaching younger people, because we're not taught it in typical education.
Yep. I think that's a really big point. And that's one thing that I was pleased. My daughter had a birthday last week, and I just checked her Step account this morning, and she has moved the birthday money from her grandmother into her savings inside Step.
Wow.
That was I was happy to see that, because she likes to spend money.
Don't we all?
Yes. Okay, moving on from a neobank for teenagers to America's oldest bank. I didn't realize this until today. BNY Mellon apparently was started by Alexander Hamilton.
Yep.
That's pretty cool. So BNY Mellon, the oldest bank in America, is actually getting into crypto, and they're getting into crypto custody, the first of the big banks, and they are one of eight systemically important financial institutions in this country, and the first of those to be a crypto custodian. Really interesting, really interesting development, and being approved by the Fed, by the New York Department of Financial Services. So they are apparently, taking on a handful of clients this week. So big news from BNY Mellon.
Just another notch in the crypto belt for traditional FIs getting involved. I think the part of the story that fascinates me, and it's a kind of a subsequent story that we'll touch on, is BNY Mellon gets approved, and Custodia Bank in Wyoming immediately files a petition, as they've been kind of sitting in limbo for, 2 years now, Peter?
Yep.
It feels like they've obviously made the case that they're being unfairly treated. But it doesn't seem that they are, considering that I think initial deadlines were this is an 8-month process, and it's well beyond that now. And if they're going to start approving firms like BNY Mellon, at some point they need to give at least some sort of answer to Arcadia.
Mm-hmm. To Peter's point, it's about resourcing and thinking through what is systemically important for the sanctity of the capital markets here. And they are a designated SIFI. And to maintain that designation is incredibly important. Like, I worked at ESIFMU, so the Depository Trust and Clearing Company. Yeah, I know. It's another one for you. It is, they're clearing entities within them. So the Depository Trust Corporation, the NSCC, and so forth. But they maintain the security of the capital markets, and these designations were as a result of the financial crisis. So for someone like BNY to get into this, and then the DTCC to have often been working on multiple different projects in the crypto space, is a positive development, because there are efficiencies. And again, later story we'll be chatting about is the merge, right? And the efficiencies that have been gained there, like for the crypto industry, this is a positive move, where we have institutional capital ready to start to make a move here. And you need to move the largest players first in order to make a market move.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a surprise that the Fed's going to say that, the BNY Mellon, it's in some ways less risky for them to approve BNY Mellon than it is to approve Custodia, because Custodia is a brand new bank, and they, you know, while they have experienced people on staff, they are still a startup. And but you know, I think the point is that what I know when you hear Caitlin Long speak, and when reading some of her writings, what she just wants is communication. And
that's what we all
getting. She's not getting communication from the government on what else she needs to do. That looks like they're just sort of stringing her along. And so she's filed a petition in U.S. court in Wyoming, which is their home state. And you know, there's no action that's going to be taken other than this, but she wants to, she's not suing, well, she's in the process of suing them for beforehand, but this is just another point that she's saying that we, if you're saying this is not okay, don't approve BNY Mellon and say it's still not okay, because clearly the concept is okay.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, I think to me, the bigger long-term story really is, you know, we've heard about this crypto crash and all the bad things happening. It might actually end up being the best time crypto has had because of all the institutional players that have now doubled down into a strategy that maybe they were kind of on the edges on. BlackRock. Now you have, you know, BNY Mellon. I mean, you have the oldest, most important names in traditional finance, all essentially giving a stamp of approval in some way or another, Fidelity. Of crypto and at least the value of getting into the space. And I think we're going to look back in the last, you know, sometime in the next few years and say that was potentially a turning point for the, you know, large scale adoption was the crypto winter, which gave a lot of these institutions, you know, maybe the space that they needed or at least the impetus that they needed. I don't know.
I agree with you. I think the parallels here, when we think about when is the best time to build a company, it's in a recession. It's in a downturn. It's when there's opportunity and there's hunger and there's hustle. And this might be, and again, the efficiencies that have been created from an infrastructure standpoint during this period of time have been beneficial to shepherd this new wave of innovation. Maybe this is how the banks innovate in their period of a pullback.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Instead of going in and buying a bunch of fintech companies, they just go buy a bunch of blockchains.
Right. Yep, who knows? Okay, moving on to another fintech innovation, Buy Now, Pay Later, article in the Wall Street Journal this week. Buy Now, Pay Later is still a credit score blind spot. And you know, this is something that really has to change because it's become BNPL is so, you know, it's so popular now, becoming more so. Consumers love it. You know, I had Greg Wright from Experian on my podcast. I think it was like very early this year, so 9 months ago or thereabouts. And he talked about the credit bureau that Experian was building just for BNPL. Clearly, it's not. You know, and back then he was saying all the major BNPL players are reporting data to Experian. But clearly they haven't done anything formal as far as getting this into the bureaus in a way that can, you know, acknowledges the fact that this is a very different product to a traditional credit product. So
I think they're struggling with it.
Yeah.
You know, to be honest, because, you know, you had the story that we're referencing, there was a study done by a credit reporting firm. I don't think it mentioned the firm, but it said 57% of like 130 million BNPL transactions, 57% of those by consumers would have had a material credit score decrease. And those are even if they paid it off or were, you know, on time with payments, which shows that there's a problem in how it's reported and understood by the credit agencies, because it's probably just showing as, oh my God, they have 10 loans and they've overextended, when that's not really the case.
Mm-hmm.
That was the part that I drilled in on as well. So we go back to the mission and why the CFPB was established, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and to protect consumers against harms in the financial markets. Now, they want to boost credit scores. They want to be able to empower people, underwrite thin file consumers, and get people on the right track. To that point of data, this feels like it's a bit counter to that narrative, because this will impact them in a negative way.
Yeah. I mean, they've got to change. They've got to change the system, because I mean, you say if you take out a BNPL loan, it's 100% utilization of a credit line that opens and closes in 6 weeks. That is not how the credit.
And it could be like $75.
Goes. Yeah.
Like, how is that? How can that be a detriment to someone's credit when it's like it could be in some way? If obviously they'd never pay it, but they need to figure out how to report that $75 and not get that person dinged for having $575 charges.
But here's the other thing. It's as part of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the FCRA, it doesn't make BNPL a requirement. So it seems like they're pushing the industry in a direction that they really don't have any oversight of. So maybe there's more to come on this, and we don't know what their next move is, and they have programs and structure in place, and maybe they have, you know, a way to get their arms around it. But, you know, the point to this is, like, yes, consumers are taking these things out. We really don't have a way of tracking and controlling it until that first transaction hits, and it might already be too late. The best way I can surmise is tracking their email addresses, being able to say, like, hey, you got an email from Affirm, and you got an email from Zip and all these other ones at the same time. It might be that you're a little bit overloaded. How do you help actually create a scenario for these consumers before they get into trouble and that it's negatively impacting their credit score?
Yeah, I mean, I think in Experian, we're very confident that they've nailed this problem, but they haven't rolled it out. That's the thing. It's still, I mean, these large firms, and rightly so, you know, they can't just roll out something without a lot of testing, and clearly they're still in that process. So yeah, more to come, as you say, Lindsay. So
yes, it's an easy one.
Yes, moving on. We had the acting head of the OCC. Isn't it strange? We're 2 years from an election. And we still have an acting head of the OCC.
At least they kept him longer than Brooks.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes. So anyway, we have the acting head of the OCC this week was speaking at DC FinTech Week, and he was basically saying that the OCC wants more data on banks' crypto-related activities. Yes, they do. What a surprise. He says they want to understand, you know, obviously the bank exposure to crypto, and there's just, you know, he talks about the different types of data they're looking for, and they want to monitor crypto activities, and because they have risk of contagion, of course. But you know, it's not a surprise. I feel like the OCC, they need this data. If they're going to have, like, you know, the OCC, I'm sure, regulates the Bank of BNY Mellon. So they're, you know, they're going to be putting more requirements on any bank that's doing crypto activities, it seems.
If I was in the crypto space, I'd, you know, be one. I mean, there's no way for wide scale adoption unless you're sharing this data with regulators to prove that what you're doing, unless you're on the, you know, super decentralized my keys my crypto side, if you're kind of in the middle where you want to transact with the traditional financial system but in a better, more efficient, you know, lower cost way, and blockchain is a part of that, then you should be welcoming sharing data with regulators, and they should also, as an industry, kind of be trying to push, how can we give you what you need to ensure that what we're doing you get comfortable with.
Okay, moving on, we are going to talk about crypto hacks. This was news to me. I hear of the crypto hacks, and you sort of just, you know, they're almost every day.
Yep, it feels like it.
And so this apparently October. We're October 13th right now, and this is already the worst month for crypto hacks, and we still have more than 2 weeks to go. $718 million has been stolen from DeFi protocols across 11 different hacks in the last since October 1st. Chainalysis has this data, and so yeah, the crypto industry got to get their act together. This is just these sort of headlines. How can DeFi be taken seriously by those in, you know, the that are in the big money when this sort of stuff keeps happening? A lot of it's bridges, but still, it's not a good look.
Agreed. I mean, that creates panic, and in a panic, people make a flight to safety. And given that the perception is that these are not safe and there is no regulatory consistency, obviously people are panicking. But I wonder how much of this is a bit, again, parallels between what is happening in crypto and happening in the rest of private venture capital markets. When a, you know, scenario where we report a funding announcement, that funding has probably already happened. Like, how much of this is just all getting bubbled up to the surface because people are like, well, they're sharing their data. Let's just all get it out in the open and air the dirty laundry. Like, how much of this, to the data point, there's clearly a gap in the regulators' ability to catch and mitigate these things. And the companies are like, well, we're still dealing with these hair on fire opportunities and trying to make it right before we know how bad the damage is, which is not great because there's no protocol for them, you know, 24-hour turnaround or SLA. So there's probably like a lot of other things that are happening, but everyone's like, well, they've got a terrible headline. Ours is less bad. Let's just go out and just right. tell them how bad the damage is.
Yeah, there's probably definitely some truth to that. And when I talked to a couple of people in crypto over the summer, one we did a podcast with, he said this was arguably the biggest thing the industry needs to figure out is security. You know, a lot of people love the concept of blockchains. It's efficiency, it's immutable, the ledger. But if they can't understand and fix the security issue, they're dead in the water. And it's a huge problem. And every time a regulator sees $700 million stolen from somewhere, they're just going to mention that 100 times in a hearing or behind closed doors to crypto firms. Like, you guys need to get a handle on this.
Right.
And so, you know, I think it's going to be a problem, and hopefully in 2023, it doesn't end up being as bad as 2022, but it's trending in the wrong direction right now.
Yeah. I think trouble with a lot of these DeFi protocols, I mean, they want to live in like a multi-chain world and be able to bridge between different protocols, but man, it seems like the bridges that there's something going on there, and I don't understand the tech well enough to know, but clearly hackers have found a vulnerability and they just keep going after these things. And so I'd like to hear from a story one day that this bridge is unhackable.
And, like the poorly protected one, you could kind of understand. It's probably an early stage company that kind of, you know, they haven't gotten everything in place yet. All right, the low hanging fruit, and hackers will kind of try to pick them off. But some of the other stuff, these are from well established companies in the space that you would think they'd have a bit better handle on. And like you said, Pierre, I'm not an expert or an engineer, but seems like they're missing something.
Right.
Process. Yeah. They're missing process. They're missing risk mitigating controls and auditors. Putting my SIFMU hat back on, they go in and check the protocols, but they have to check them more frequently. It's not like in a scenario with a regular, you know, security, and you're vesting into your options over time. Like, that doesn't change. It's a piece of paper. It's managed at a record keeper, like a pulley or a carta. This is coded. That code needs to be checked every time, even when you move it off the chain. Like, there are vulnerabilities that are not being properly audited, or however you want to say it, reviewed. And that's part of this like immaturity of the industry in and of itself, but also a lack of oversight from regulatory bodies and a lack of compliance and accounting guidelines and standard operating procedures. Like, it will mature over time, but it's sad that the real victims here are the people that are trying to implement this technology and get it to scale and get it to market and believe so fundamentally in it, but it's literally draining them of their livelihoods.
Right. Yes, indeed. Okay, we're going to close with another crypto story. This is the first study I've seen post-merge. Morgan Stanley has looked at the crypto ecosystem, and it says Ethereum, post-merge, now it's proof of stake and not proof of work, says it's becoming less decentralized, with 60% of validators managed by only four companies. And a lot of these are like the hosting companies. Said 65% of Ethereum's nodes are cloud hosted, and half of those, so 32% or so of those, about of all of the Ethereum nodes, are on AWS. Not really a surprise as far as I can see. AWS are really the big.
The Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation has a monopoly on the US capital markets. Like, this has never been a real concern. There's something else here. They're missing out, or they're the bony thing is getting to them. This is the wrong angle for them to be taking personally.
Well, I mean, the whole thing they're saying, you know, like the whole thing about Ethereum, that, you know, it's all decentralized, and there are some decentralized purists. I am certainly not one of them. I don't think this is a big deal at all. But the decentralized purists, they are very much focused on the fact that Ethereum is decentralized, and, you know, it's less decentralized now with proof of stake. I think that was always going to be expected, because there's just less nodes, less people validating the blockchain. So,
and that's creating the problem with the vulnerabilities in the hack because of the nodes and the complexity and the design of the network. But this proof of work transition is monumental. The savings from an environmental perspective are roughly 99.9% right. of the energy yep. that they was previously utilizing, which has been a big grip with some regulators. And you're also talking about security and efficiency improvements, because already it's been compared so many times to how many payment networks and its inability as a fraction of its potential. So the bigger story here is, I don't care how it happens, it's getting moved in the positive right direction. Yeah. And you either get on board with the strategy or get out of the way.
Okay. Yeah, that's a perfect way to end.
Yep, well said, Lindy. Okay, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for watching or listening, everybody. We'll be back same time next week. But before we go, just want to give a heads up, a shout out to our Latin American event happening in Miami, December 13th and 14th. Go to fintechnexus.com to find out more. If you're interested in LATAM fintech, it's going to be the place to be. With that, have a great evening and great weekend, everybody. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks, Lindsay.
Yeah, thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you. Always a pleasure. Bye.